The first project that we have for the first hour is to talk about his life. In a little book called Costly Grace by Eberhard Bethke, Bethke says that if we have any chance of understanding Bonhoeffer's work, we have to understand his life. In other words, this pile of books is not separable from the Gestapo. Okay. The whole experience of National Socialism and of this theology and of the rise and fall of the Reich is all blended together, and so the life and the person and the work must all blend together. We will try to find some time as we go through these things to discuss some of the following questions. In what way does American culture and American religion fight with each other? In other words, in what way does the culture of the United States, Winnebagos and McDonald's and all that stuff, in what way does the culture of America seduce the church? Okay. The experience of Bonhoeffer was the, you could say, 99.9% seduction of the church by the state. It was very, very successful in seducing the church to its own ends. In what way does American culture seduce the church today? It's not an old question. When we study Bonhoeffer, we're studying something that is very much alive and very real today, and that's one of the questions. A related question that we have to talk about. What is the function of the church over against the state? How do the two talk to each other? What's the relationship? Is it appropriate for the flag to fly next to the altar? Is it appropriate for the pastor in town to go to the city council and to pray before they have zoning, a meeting about zoning, etc.? Should we have prayer in public schools? Okay. One of the big campaign issues that we're working on in the fall of 1980 is prayer in public schools. It's a relationship with church and state. And as we talk about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I hope that you'll start to see some connections. I don't think we'll ever end up by saying, you know, that's absolutely the way it must be. But at least what we do when we go back into this history and into this theology, we are looking at other people's experiences, and we hope that they'll inform our own. Another thing we look at is something very personal to us. In what way do your parents and your brothers and sisters influence your faith? And that's, you know, on one level we can talk about the state versus the church, but on a much different level we have to talk about who is your mother and who is your father and who are your brothers and sisters and what do they mean to you? How do they help you? How do they hinder you as you try to be a faithful disciple? That's a very big part of the Bonhoeffer story. His life and work cannot be separated from his family. He was not the shining star of his family. Not at all. He was one of many bright lights in the family. He was normal for the Bonhoeffer family. A good share of the family was executed by the time the war was over. So that's one of the things we have to talk about. Question, another issue. When you feel like your church is wrong, how do you respond to it? What are your methods for protest? Another question, who is Jesus today? That was, Bethke says, that was Bonhoeffer's number one question. Who is Jesus today? At one point, Bonhoeffer could say he thought that Gandhi was Jesus alive today. In our terms, maybe you would say Martin Luther King was Jesus in America. Now, you may or may not want to come to that conclusion. If you grew up in Polish Chicago, maybe you would conclude that Mayor Daley was Jesus today. He was Jesus for us. Does that sound awful? Well, okay. The question is an important one, and it means that when Christ came to be with us, that his being with us continues to go on. And so one of the jobs we have is to ask each other, who is Jesus? And that was one of Bonhoeffer's big projects. Well, we need another personal dimension. We talked about family. Another personal dimension is to talk about confession. You making private confession to pastor or priest
or friend. And those of you who grew up in the Roman Catholic tradition have done that and have experienced it. Those of us in the Protestant tradition have lost it. It was reinstituted by Bonhoeffer, private confession. Just imagining what that would be for yourself, try to be thinking, how would it feel to tell the truth to another person? And then to have that person respond only with a psalm and a benediction. Private confession. Okay. Another level I want to get into is the question of Bonhoeffer saying that Jesus, that studying Jesus is the only true science in the world. Everything else is relative. There is only one thing worth studying, and that's Jesus. Okay. He really makes audacious claims all the way through. I mean, he dismisses all the rest of reality. This only thing that's real, the science, is theology. He always never very equivocal about things. He'd just say stuff like that. Everything else was unreal. Another statement that we need to look at. The single visible sign of the church in the world is the cross. The only visible sign of the church in the world is the cross. What's that mean? Theologica Cruce, the theology of the cross. John Schramm is going to lecture on theology of glory, theology of cross for us, and that's a part of that. Well, lots of issues. And those are but a few. So what I hope that you'll sense is that we're going to talk about big things like church-state relations. We're going to talk about private things like who's your mom and how does she affect you, and everything in between. And all that is a big part of the story. Now, we start with a biography. And what I'll do now is to show you some photographs and to talk about, to give you a biographical review of Bonhoeffer, and while telling the story of his life, weave in the story of the books. Now, and the books we'll come back to. This was his picture. He's born in 1906. He died in 1945. He was from an aristocratic family and was a pastor, a theologian, a very good pianist, played Chopin and Brahms like crazy, and played soccer and a number of other things. He had a twin sister named Sabina. That's her right there on this side, Sabina. There were seven kids in the family. Sabina and Dietrich were numbers five and six. The rise and fall of the Third Reich, as this photograph shows, is the context in which his study in ministry and theology was done. So church-state relations are obviously a big part of what he has to talk about. He worked with other people. We'll see some of those photographs later on. A guy named Johansson. And let's see, what else can I show you? He was imprisoned in this place for a while, Tegel Prison. He was 2 years here. He was more than 3 years in jail altogether at Flossenbürg and two other places. This was actually his cell, number 10, on the third floor. They kept track of all that stuff. And this is the man named Eberhard Bethke. Bethke wrote this little book called Costly Grace, and he wrote this big fat one here that contains more stuff than you ever want to know for $10. This is the definitive biography on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And also he is responsible for the publication of Ethics and the publication of, I forget what else, some lectures. Bethke is a relative of Dietrich's and was a friend and a correspondent. He wrote letters and papers in prison. He corresponded back and forth, and Bethke now travels around the United States a lot and around the world, lecturing on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And much of what we know about him is because of Eberhard Bethke. This is Maria von Wiedemeyer-Weller. He was engaged to her when he was in prison. The wedding never happened. She was the daughter of a countess, one of the places where Dietrich stayed when he was on the lam, when he was running from the Nazis, was at a very big and cushy house, and the countess had a daughter or a granddaughter, and this was the daughter, the granddaughter of the one of the houses where he hid out in the early 1940s. The wedding never happened. She is now living in Boston. And this is a photograph of Flossenbürg Prison where the execution took place. And this is the laundry room where the trial was held. Okay. A laundry room. And what else can we say? That would be enough, I guess, for now. So let's start through the story with some. You've got some pictures in mind there, and let's start. A fellow in New York City that Dietrich worked with said he was the least schizophrenic person he ever knew. Schizophrenia is having two personalities. Schizophrenia is saying one thing and doing something else. Schizophrenia is saying, I'm going to be good today and being rotten today. Okay, in the morning you say, I'm going to be nice, and all day long, you're not nice. Okay, you and I'm a very schizophrenic person because I decide one thing and end up doing something else. Paul Lehman, who teaches at Union in New York City, says of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he was the least schizophrenic person he ever knew. That if he said it, he ended up doing it. I think that's really a disgusting characteristic. Anyway, that's one comment on his life. Let's look at the very end of the story. The day before he was executed, April 8th, 1945. There, he was in prison with a number of other people. One of them was a RAF officer from England. His name was Payne Best. And Payne Best wrote in his diary the day that Dietrich was taken to the gallows the following. Bonhoeffer always seemed to me to diffuse an atmosphere of happiness, of joy, in even the smallest event of life, and of deep gratitude for the mere fact that he was alive. He was one of the very few men that I have ever met to whom God was real and close. The following day, Sunday, April 8th, 1945, Pastor Bonhoeffer held a little service in the prison that spoke to us in a manner that reached the hearts of us all, finding just the right words to express the spirit of our imprisonment and the thoughts and the resolutions which it brought. He had hardly finished his last prayer when the door opened and two men in civilian clothes came in and said, Prisoner Bonhoeffer, get ready and come with us. Those words, come with us, for all prisoners, they had come to mean only one thing, the scaffold. We bade him goodbye. He drew me aside. This is the end, he said, for me, the beginning of life. Next day, he was hung. 3 years earlier, in prison, he wrote a little note out to his friend Eberhard Bethke, and the little note said, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. The cross, come and die, that's the goal of the Christian life, that's the vocation of the Christian. All of that very much dominates Bonhoeffer's life. He did lots of things. By age 21, he had a PhD. He was a preacher at the 1936 Olympics, where Jesse Owens won 4 gold medals. He was a professor at the University of Berlin. He taught confirmation in a ghetto in the city of Berlin. And he worked underground as a double agent with the Abwehr, the Nazi CIA. He was a part of the Ecumenical Church and traveled to Sweden and Switzerland, Norway and England. He was a grad student at Union Seminary twice, and also had he smoked quite a little bit, and he also had a good sense of humor, at least that's what his friends report, that he was exceedingly intense and then would break out in laughter. So, at least that's some of the characteristics that he had. Let's go back and let's look at family. His dad is born in 1906, 7 kids in the family. Sabina and Dietrich were twins. They were number 5 and 6, as I indicated. His father was a psychiatrist, the first psychiatrist at the University of Berlin faculty. The rest of his family, his father's relatives, were all just kind of like that. They were judges and lawyers and physicians and on, no clergy. His mom's side of the family was the same thing. They were really a patrician family. They were very, very accomplished people on both sides. I mean, they both had family trees and lots of VONs in front of their name, which meant that they were sort of high-class, hotsy-totsy folks. I better stick to this.
The family life was very structured. They had Sunday afternoon concerts. They had a specific time for recreation. The father's study was father's study. At one point, Dietrich writes something about reflecting on his childhood, that he was in his father's study only a few times in his life. I mean, father was father, okay? And father worked in there, and the children stayed out here. So there was structure to the family. The children did not go to public school. The teachers came to the house. Okay, kind of get a feeling for the family now a little bit. When baptisms were held, the pastor came to the house. The child was not brought to church. Okay, the neighborhood was in a neighborhood of Berlin that had a lot of professional people and academic types, like Adolf von Harnack. If you've ever heard that name, he's the greatest church historian since who knows whom. He was a neighbor. Other neighbors were Jewish, and so they grew up in that sort of environment. His brothers were all of rather talented people. One older brother was a physicist and worked with Albert Einstein. And that sort of story goes on through the family. So what Dietrich does is not a... I asked you about the relationship that you have with your family. Okay. This, whatever he accomplished, was rather normal for the Bonhoeffer family. They all sort of did these things. Many of them ended up dead by the end of the war. They had a very large summer home in the south of Germany, and it was so big that they had a gardener and a cook and a maid who lived there full time. When the Bonhoeffer children were married, Mrs. Bonhoeffer did not give them a set of Melmac. What she gave them was a house full of furniture and a maid. Okay? What are you going to get? When you get married, what do you want to get from your mommy? You want to... Anyway, that was the kind of gift that they got. The church was not important to the Bonhoeffer family, but it wasn't really important to anybody in Germany at the time. Well, very few people. The church was rather a boring institution. At age 17, Dietrich decides to study theology. The family is not particularly impressed, but they're not depressed over it either. By age 17, a child in this family is not a child. They are an adult. By the time they're 12 and 13, they're making very responsible decisions about their own life. By the time they're 17, they're deciding on academic careers or whatever. And the family just says, well, it's your choice. Obviously, you're an adult, you know, at 17. His relationship with his family all through his life remains very, very strong. In the letters and papers from prison that were published posthumously by Eberhard Bethke, you will see many, many deep, you'll read many, many deep and warm references to family life and messages to his parents. He wrote and said, I hummed Wagner's such and such this afternoon in my prison cell. I hope you hummed it with, play it with me on the piano at home, and I'll hum it here in jail. And then he said, I remember the night we all sat around the fire and read such and such together. Okay. So that very intense family loyalty was a big... In fact, the reason he got executed, Larry Rasmussen says one of the reasons he got executed, was because he was so deeply entwined in his family, and members of his family, brother-in-laws, Hans von Danje especially, got involved with the plot to kill Hitler and involved Dietrich in that plot, and that all led finally to his execution. His father had one characteristic that's important for us to know, and you're going to see it all the way through the literature that we talk about. One of the characteristics that his dad insisted upon was that when they all sat around and visited, fantasy or nonsense was never allowed. I mean, you can just picture Herr Professor, you know, Bonhoeffer, the professor at the university. No fantasy. Everything had to be real. If a child spoke, if one of the Bonhoeffer children spoke, the father said, tell us what you have to say, say it clearly, and finish it. Speak and then be quiet. Yeah, that's right. Can you just picture this guy's got spit-shine black shoes on? Father Bonhoeffer does. He says, speak, and then you're done. No, don't rattle on. Don't dream up stuff. Don't fool around. Speak and then be quiet. He had an immense dislike for fantasy and had a tremendous love for real things. All the time he talked about real stuff. So all through Dietrich's theology, you're going to hear reality is a big word. The Nazis are real. Jesus is real. The church is real. You know, evil is real. And that theme goes through all. Jesus is real, not just a spiritual sort of buzz we get, you know. Jesus is a real thing. Community is real. Okay. That goes on through the whole thing. 21 years of age, he receives his doctor's degree. He writes an essay. His doctoral dissertation is something called The Communion of Saints. And it's 21. How you doing? Communion of Saints, I've never read the thing at all, but what other people write about it is that it's very scholastic and extremely difficult to read and very heady and etc. I don't even own a copy, and I might buy it if you gave me one, I might try to read it, but I don't like hard books like that. He's 22. What I'm going to do is go through years, and I'm going to go fast, and it may drive you crazy. So but anyway, that's what I want to do. He's 22 years of age, and the Nazis are not yet in power. He has finished his doctoral work. He takes 1 year as an intern, as a seminary intern in Barcelona, Spain, in a German-speaking congregation. Nothing very important happens while he's doing that. At age 24, he presents another paper in addition to his doctoral paper. Another paper so that he can gain admission to the university faculty. You got a job in the university by writing some big thing, see? And you bring it in, you set it down on Adolf von Harnack's desk and say, Adolf, read this thing. And Adolf says, hey, you're really smart. If you want to offer to teach at the university, you can. Now, that didn't mean you had any students. All it meant was, yeah, we'll put your name on the bulletin board. You follow that? In other words, you didn't have a bunch of freshmen assigned to Dietrich's class. It was that you could take his courses if you wanted to. Well, at age 24, he was accepted on the theological faculty at the university, and he became a very popular teacher very early on, right from the start.
Which university was it?
University of Berlin, right in the city. He is offered a trip to New York City to do postdoctoral study at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. He does that, and he does that through primarily through the Niebuhr family. An interesting thing happens. On the trip over to New York City, on the ship, he meets a physician from India. The physician from India tells him about Gandhi. One of Bonhoeffer's characteristics that goes all through his life is that when he meets anybody, whether it's a Roman Catholic from Barcelona or an Indian physician, or anyone, including, he worked in Harlem in New York City for a while, I'll get to that in a minute. He's interested in everything. He has an insatiable appetite to find out what's going on around him. His most enjoyable thing is to pick people's brains and to listen very carefully. He meets a pacifist on the ship. Do you understand that there are no German pacifists? There are no German Lutheran pacifists. There is no theology to support pacifism. There is no such thing as conscientious objection in his whole background or in his theology, maybe by the time certainly he'd heard of it. But he's alert and open enough to find everybody interesting. I don't find everybody interesting. I only find certain non-threatening people interesting who can talk to me about what I already know about. Right, is how are you, right? I mean, he likes to talk to people who have all sorts of new reflections and feelings about things. So later on in his life, he becomes a confirmed pacifist. There are very many different levels of pacifism, obviously. The dean of our faculty this summer and next summer was Larry Rasmussen. This book is called Reality and Resistance. It's Larry's doctoral dissertation from Union Seminary in New York. Same place Dietrich went. It is on the question, why did Dietrich become a conspirator in the plot to kill Hitler when in fact he was a pacifist? What are the theological and personal transformations that move a man from one spot to the next? One of the things we'll do in our five sessions is to go through Larry's book. in New York City. He is a student, and he writes in his diary on a Sunday morning, "I hope to hear a sermon this morning." He goes to Riverside Church or to the other big Protestant cathedrals of New York City. Norm has been to many of them, having lived right in the neighborhood, right? Kent was a student at Union, right? Okay. He writes in his diary, I hope to hear a sermon this morning. Sunday night, he writes in his diary, I heard an interesting talk today. He heard sermons on things like truth, beauty, loveliness, music. Yeah. Nothing about Jesus, nothing about the church or any of that stuff. He heard nice talks. So instead of going to church at those places, and that was really sort of an example of sophisticated American Christianity at the time. Let's all get together and talk about truth. You know, that's a nice and harmless thing to talk about. So instead of going to church at these places, he decides he wants to go to church with a friend of his who is also a student union seminary, and so they start going to church in Harlem. He becomes a Sunday school teacher in Harlem, and he worships there most of the time. He also picks up the music of Harlem. He is a good musician already. About 5 years later, when he's back in Germany setting up an illegal seminary, they make up a little song book, a Beanie-Sing book, okay, a Beanie-Sing book. And this little song book has in it Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, okay? So that's some of the stuff. Then he also writes in his diary that in Harlem, he sees two things. First, he says, I hear the gospel preached. The second thing is, I see the seed of a revolution coming to America. 1930 or 31, early on. Okay. Age 25, he's back in Berlin. He teaches at the university, and he is a professor of various things. His lecture notes, some of the lecture notes that we have from that time, are Creation and Fall and Temptation, two biblical studies. These are not difficult to read, and it gives an insight into what he was doing and what his mind was like at age 25 as a young and up-and-coming professor. He's also working on Genesis. Now something happens to him that's very important. At age 25, while at the university, he experiences what we would now call a conversion. He had a very intense dislike for conversion experiences. He did not tell his own experience to anyone, and he was very impatient if you tried to tell your story to him. He simply wasn't interested. He said, I want to hear about Jesus. I do not want to hear about you. He says, and my story will not save you. No, but his story will. Okay. But he goes through, so take this conversion experience in context. But anyway, let me read this. Something happened to me. Something that has changed and transformed my life to the present day. For the first time, I discovered the Bible. Okay. He's a professor of New Testament, a professor of biblical literature. He says, I discovered the Bible. I had often preached. I had seen a great deal of the church and talked and preached about it, but I had not yet become a Christian. I know that at that time, I turned the doctrine of Jesus Christ into something of personal advantage for myself. I pray to God that'll never happen again. Also, I had never prayed, or prayed only very little. For all my loneliness, I was quite pleased with myself. Then the Bible, in particular the Sermon on the Mount, freed me from that. Since then, everything has changed. I have felt this plainly, and so have other people about me. It was a great liberation. It became clear to me that the life of a servant of Jesus Christ must belong to the church, and step by step, it became plainer to me how far that must go. From Eberhard Bethke, page 154. I just think that's sort of nice. I mean, I just think it's interesting that professors of theology have to be converted just like you and I do, right? Often and regularly. I think that's sort of good. He mentions what part of the Bible? He mentions the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Later on, one of the things we're going to look at is the cost of discipleship. This is a biblical study on the Sermon on the Mount. For him, for Bonhoeffer, the Sermon on the Mount was the heart and core of the Christian faith and the guideline to discipleship. Age 25, experiences this conversion sort of thing. He is a professor at the university. He's also teaching a confirmation class in the Wedding district, W-E-D-D-I-N-G. There are 50, I don't know where the girls were, but there were 50 boys in the confirmation class. The previous pastor had a heart attack and died, and so Bonhoeffer was assigned to do this job. I mean, he didn't come forward and sort of gallantly volunteer for the thing. He was busy enough, but he was assigned by his superior in the church to do this. See, as a professor, he was a part of the church, and so his superiors were the bishops of the church, not the university people. You follow that? Okay, so when he was assigned to do this confirmation, it was by his church superiors. 50 boys. The wedding district is sort of the South Bronx of Berlin. Okay. No running water, cold water flats, a very, very difficult neighborhood and difficult situation. He goes to class the first day, and there's a chaos. The class is held on the third floor of this old school building, and the students are ringing the banister, and they're throwing paper down at him as he walks in the door and he looks up. So he walks up there, and having been schooled now for 2 to 3 years in pacifism and in Gandhi and all that stuff, he stands in the hall, and he stands there for a good long time until everything just calms down, because he doesn't respond. He just looks at these 50 students. So everything quiets down. And then after it's quiet for a good long while, he writes this in his diary that night, he said to them, "Would you like me to tell you stories about Negroes?" And they all said, "Huh, yeah," they never met one, you know. So they walked in the classroom and he begins to tell stories. No books, no pencils, no paper. All he does is tell stories, Bible stories and stories about the church and about Jesus and all. That's all he did for confirmation. And it went on for about 2 years. When the confirmation class graduated, the parents of the confirmands were very poor, obviously, so he asked his mom for money to buy the cloth for their confirmation robes. She did, and the parents then made the things. And then he gave the class a gift, and the gift was to put them all on the train and to take them 2.5 hours south to their summer home, where for a weekend they played soccer on the front lawn, and his dad paid for the train tickets and all the rest of that stuff. And they broke out some windows with a soccer ball, and they wrote to his dad, "I hope you don't mind." He says, "In addition to the train expenses, you also have some broken windows." But anyway, what that means, a part of that whole story means to me that on one level, he was the professor. He was the Herr Professor. But on another level, he enjoyed Harlem, and he enjoyed 50 kids. There were no such things as youth pastors who took kids on retreats, okay? That wasn't going on, I don't think, at the time. But he did that as a part of his ministry. This double dimension of tremendous discipline and scholarship, along with a playful soccer, music, humor dimension, really is a double dimension to his life, and both seem extremely intense most all of the time, except later on the humor part certainly does fade away. He's 26 years old. He's invited to an ecumenical conference. Ecumenical means lots of churches talking to each other. This was a brand new thing. He was early in on the whole experience of Catholics and Anglicans and Lutherans and Calvinists talking to each other. And those ecumenical ties that he made in Scandinavia and in England become very important later on. When the church in Germany tries to tell the church in America that they're burning Jews in the ovens, they need avenues for this information to go out. You've maybe seen this on the Holocaust show or read it in Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, whatever. How do they get information out? I mean, Life magazine isn't going to publish it. One of the avenues that they use is the ecumenical contacts that that Bonhoeffer and a few other people developed early on. There's a fellow in England by the name of Bell who becomes extremely important. Now, we leave that story, and we are at 1933. Are you with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
Are you all right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In 1933, January of that year, Hitler is elected Chancellor of the Reich. A month later, systematic attacks begin on German Jews, eliminating them from public life and from the professions. Dietrich is now 27 years of age. He and some other people publish a little essay called The Church and the Jewish Problem. By the end of the summer of 1933, Bonhoeffer, along with a fellow by the name of Martin Niemöller and some others, establish what is called the Pastors' Emergency League. What we're going to do in the next hour is to talk about the confessing church as opposed to the German Christian church and the regular church. All I'm suggesting to you now is that at age 26, early in 1933, just within 1 year of the election of Hitler within months after Hitler's election to be a Reichschancellor, there begins a small group of people, a protest to Nazism. The next hour is a careful, well, I hope it's careful, is an analysis of the resistance, the church's resistance against Nazism. So I'm not going to get into a whole lot of that now. Only to say that there develops within Germany three churches: the confessing church, the German Christian church, and then the regular church. And we're going to spell that out the next hour after coffee break. He's 29 years of age. The resistance to the Nazi experience is going on. He is so frustrated with the whole church that he's called by a German-speaking congregation in London, and he takes it. And it's, I mean, sometimes you cop out, you know, you just say, I can't cope anymore and I'm going to go away and have a good time. I think that his going to England was a cop out. I mean, he was just burned out from a few years of struggling against the Nazis and trying to influence his church in Germany. And when he got a call to come to London to be a pastor of a German-speaking church, two little congregations, very small congregations, he said, all right, I'll go. I'm sick of this. So he went to London. But within a matter of months after he was in London, he got involved with the Germans in England and their resistance to Hitler. So, I mean, he did take a vacation for a while, but he quickly got back into the swing of things again. At age 29, he's in England. He's invited to come back to Germany to set up a preacher's seminary. Now, if you were to be a pastor, you would go to the university, okay? And there you'd study theology and music and liturgy and etc. And then after that time, you'd do a one-year internship, and then you'd become a pastor. Now, a pastor was a civil servant, okay? They were postal people, and there were bureaucrats, and there were pastors, and there were, you get the picture? It was a church-state relationship. Now, the confessing church, and I'm not going to go into all that now, we're going to do that the next hour. The confessing church said, we cannot afford to send to our congregations pastors who are trained at the university. Because these people were making pledges to Hitler, these pastors, they were making swearing oaths of allegiance to the state, and we'll go into the details of those oaths and etc. the next hour. But what Bonhoeffer was called to do was to establish a seminary, a preacher's training college, on behalf of the confessing church. Six such seminaries were set up. He set up one in Finkenwalde. He was 29 years old when he was. How old are you? Anybody here 29? How are we doing? This little place had 25 students. It was located on the Baltic Sea, And it was life together. They raised their own food. They got food from other people. They had their own library. There were two faculty. They did dishes together and all that sort of stuff. Okay, and the little book, Life Together, is a description after this was over. This experiment lasted for 3 years. It was shut down twice. And finally, instead of establishing a new building, what they did was to put it on Meals on Wheels. They had seminary on wheels, is essentially what it amounted to. I mean, they'd get eight people together in a living room and they'd have class all day and then they'd scatter because it was becoming increasingly more difficult to survive. You're asking the question, did the Nazis permit this? I mean, what was going on? I mean, did the Gestapo know they were doing this? What was going on with that whole thing? Yes, they knew. It was a funny relationship. The Confessing Church protested the Nazi movement all through this history. And they were tolerated, although the persecution was not very subtle toward the end. In fact, it was just plain brutal. At the university, when you would study to become a pastor, you studied theology, music, literature, and other sometimes important and other sometimes boring things. Dietrich teaches the same things at his seminary, but he adds a new course. Okay? These are Dietrich's lecture notes at this illegal, rural, underground Finkenwalde seminary. The cost of discipleship. The basis for the cost of discipleship is Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount. We'll look at this in particular in the next few days. In addition, we have from this time period not only cost of discipleship and life together, but we also have Psalms, the prayer book of the Bible. Forget it. It's now 1936. Hitler was elected in 33, and now it's 3 years later in 36. What happens in 1936? Jesse Owens? The Olympics, right, in Berlin. And all of the Jew not permitted. I've got some pictures in here of signs that say, Jews, stay off this street. All those signs were taken down. If you look in old Life magazines in your library at home, sometime flip back to 1936 and find the pictures of Berlin and the report that Life magazine and other publications in America gave about the Nazi state. I mean, it was nothing. There were nothing but glowing reports. The streets are clean, you know, the trolley cars all work, and they did. Germany was a wreck. And Hitler came in and made a run. Okay, and so Life magazine in 1936, in addition to reporting Jesse Owens winning 4 gold medals, reports that this is really a very, very well-run state, this Nazi state. Dietrich is invited to be a preacher at the Olympic Games, one of the preachers. Now, why in the world? And he was already causing trouble. Why in the world would they let him do that? I've been trying to figure that out, but it must be in that big book someplace. But he does it. He preaches at the Olympic Village, 1936, and he preaches there from October 1 through 5. On the 6th of October, his position at the University of Berlin is taken from him. His books are packed up and his office closed. He was, you see, at the time doing two things. He was professor at the university occasionally, he wasn't there often, but he still had that position. And he was also the director of this Finkenwald Seminary. Now, what we're doing here is reviewing an awful lot of stuff I hope we get back to, the details of which I think are important. Now we're going to talk about the plot to kill Hitler. Von Dohnányi, I think that's Dohnányi. He is invited into the plot to kill Hitler. There are 15 people in the plot. The details of that whole group and their process and etc. is in Larry's book, and we'll work on that. Later, and remember now, he's a pacifist, a confirmed pacifist at this point. Later in jail, he's asked, how can you, a pacifist, justify dynamite in a briefcase and trying to kill somebody like that? And he said, as a pastor in the church, said, one of my responsibilities is certainly to run out onto a major thoroughfare and pick up people who got run over by a crazy man, you know, the injured on the street. Sooner or later, sometime, he said, my responsibility is also to try to get the crazy man out from behind the wheel. Now, he never felt he was innocent. When asked, did you do something wrong? He said, yes, I did. Should you be put in jail? Yes, I should. Are you guilty? Yes, I am. Should you be executed? I didn't protest his execution. He was a guilty person. He knew he was guilty. He felt like the grace of God covered his guilt. That's a very brief statement, and Larry takes 200 pages to explain what that means. So I don't want to try to do it in one sentence, but we're going to have to work on that, on how does a person move from pacifism to what he did. I'm going to read from Eberhard Bethge again on his decision to participate in this plot. It was a painful, painful decision. Misery. He just felt awful about what he was doing. For men and nations who have never found themselves in that most unhappy state of divided loyalty, it is difficult to realize in retrospect that abnormal situation in which the most conscientious person has to accept disgrace. He was disgraced by what he did. He just felt it was a horrendous dishonor that he put upon himself. He was a disgraced man. Anyone who hastily measures the borderline situation of that time by the yardstick of his own principles, or studiously overlooks its peculiar features, distorts its contours, and does not see the reality of those months. Germany's name could no longer be saved by ordinary but blind respectability. All the world over, treason is normally thought of as a mean attitude. Speculation for one's personal advantage and the intention to injure one's own country. The opposite holds true for Oster, von Dany, and Bonhoeffer. Treason is righteousness, okay, in this situation. What is worse than doing evil is being evil, he writes. Okay? What is worse than doing evil is being evil. Blowing someone up with dynamite is an evil act, but remaining in the state but being evil is worse. The year is now 1938. Excuse me. Remember, the election happened in 33. We're now to 38. You remember Kristallnacht? The night of broken glass, now a high holy holiday for the Jewish people, Kristallnacht. On that night, 600 synagogues were burned, 7,000 Jewish shops were looted, 35,000 Jews arrested. Kristallnacht, 1938. In the first month of 1939, Hermann Göring liquidates all Jewish businesses. 2 months later, in the spring of 39, Bonhoeffer goes back to London, visits his old friend Bell and a few other people, and then is invited back to New York City for continued study at Union Theological Seminary. So all this hell is breaking out in Germany, and he gets invited back to Union in New York on a scholarship, of course, and a nice ship ride across, and lots of beer and lots of fun. So he struggles long and hard over the decision to go back to New York City. He accepts the invitation to go back. He's back 1 month. He is absolutely miserable. He simply can't stand it, what he has done. He is a miserable man. He writes in his diary, I can play no part in the reconstruction of Germany if I do not live through its tragedy. So he tells the people who are Paul Lehmann and other people in Union who arranged for his return, he said, I'm really sorry, but I just spent a lot of your money and I'm going home. So I'm sorry, but I'm going back. And he did. And he takes the next ship out, and he says that as soon as the ship pulled away, he said, from the dock, all anxiety left me. I was happy. I was going home. Soon thereafter, Germany invades Poland. Then France and Great Britain declare war. Now, from the time of his return, he lives his life on two fronts.
on the one hand, he is a part of the resistance movement, and on the other hand, he is an employee of the Nazi state. That is, he is hired by a relative, Hans von Dany, who's the second head honcho in the Nazi CIA. He's hired by his brother-in-law to be an underground agent. Gets traveling papers, gets money, gets all this stuff. Hans von Dany knows exactly what he's doing. Von Dany was one of the guys who tried to kill Hitler. So, I mean, but he said, Dietrich, you want a job? Dietrich says, what's the job? He's going to be a Nazi. So he took the job. He hated himself for taking the job. He was revolted at himself. It was just awful. He took it and a part of his job was to file false reports back to the Abwehr headquarters in Berlin. He did that. I mean, he wrote up things that were simply not happening, so everybody got confused back in Berlin. He also then could travel. He went to Norway. I mean, he didn't wear a uniform. He had a free ticket and money to go anywhere he wanted to go. Went to Switzerland, went to France, went to Rome a few times, went to Norway and Sweden and Denmark and England and around and around and around. And while he was traveling, essentially, what he was doing was working for the confessing church. He was buttonholing people and bishops and church councils and other people and saying, do you know what's happening in Germany? Can you understand what is, please, would you tell the people in America what's taking place? We, the church in America, generally did not get it, didn't figure it out, didn't make sense, in spite of the messages that kept coming out through the confessing church. He's doing two things, okay? He's working for the confessing church, and he's this fake agent. And occasionally what he'd do is just drop out. He'd hide for a month or two or three at a time. He was at a seminary, a Benedictine, was it? Ital. Yeah, it was a Benedictine abbey. Is Ruthie? Tell Ruthie. Yeah, she maybe already knows that. Ruth, are you here? No. Okay. He's working now on a book. He's writing lecture notes and thinking about the future of the church and the big issues of his own life. The title of the book is certainly no surprise. When you're a double agent and you're resisting the Nazis, okay, this word means right. What is right and what is wrong? Ethic. Okay, it is not a book. It is four attempts to start a book. These are lecture notes, and you will find some of this just horrendous scholastic Latin stuff, and it just drives you crazy. I mean, like, I don't know, where did a guy learn big words like that, you wonder? There's other parts of it that you will find fascinating. There's an essay in here that is half done, called What is Meant by Telling the Truth? So he hides at seminaries, and he hides in farmhouses, and he moves around, and there's now a price on his... I mean, he's now up for arrest, but he's working on ethics. Let's see. 36 years old. One of the places he hides is Maria von Wiedemeyer. Maria's... Remember little Maria here? She's 18 years old. Maria's grandma's house, the Countess von Baroness somebody such and such, and she's got a big house, and he hides there for a while. He gets engaged to her at this time. In 1943, now the war ends in 45. In April of 43, he's arrested. He's arrested for many things. He was speaking out against the Nazi state all this time, often underground, but sometimes just publicly speaking out against it. He was writing. And so he was arrested. He was not arrested for being a double agent. They didn't catch him on that. They arrested him for the times that he was public, that he went public with his protest. Other people were public with it too. This morning on the announcements, Marilyn said that we're going to hear today about one pastor who spent 8 years in Dachau. I mean, lots of folks gave lots of stuff to fight this thing, you know. So he wasn't the only one. April 5th, 1943, he was arrested. His brother-in-law gets arrested earlier in the day. The Mercedes pull up, and the phone call, they calls Dietrich, and he says, the Mercedes are out in front of the house. The SS is here to pick me up. Dietrich has his lecture notes. He binds them in a grocery sack, and he places them in the attic, and he tells the landlady of the house, call Eberhard and tell him where the notes are. Okay? So these little things, all the sheafs of paper, and he binds them up in a string. He goes up in the attic, and he puts them up in the top. And a few days later, Eberhard comes by and goes up there and finds them. And this is what we have.
Wouldn't the Nazis have kind of thought that he might have something like that?
I suppose they did.
Destroyed?
Yeah.
Why didn't they?
I don't know. He writes, I got my papers in order, sat down and waited. There was no point in running anywhere. There was nowhere to run. And he also felt like he couldn't run. His own credibility was so much at stake. If you're guilty, you pay the consequences. If you've been caught, you just sit and wait. You know, you don't run away, you don't deny it. Yeah, you did it. So that was a part of the thing. He is taken to Tegel prison. He's in Tegel prison for a year and a half. While in Tegel prison, he writes letters to family and friends. The first half of this book, the letters were all censored. So the second half of the book, you notice a very great change. In Tegel prison, he becomes chaplain to the prison and to the prison, to the warders and to the warden and to the guards and to others. Conducts worship services in prison and gets a lot of reading done. His family sends him packages of chocolate and other things. He has a tremendous flow of books back and forth, and that goes on for a year and a half. He is not comfortable there, but obviously it's a small cell, but he does have communication with the outside world, and the guards were very, very kind to him as well. But now, while he was in prison and before he went to prison, the 15 men that Larry Rasmussen writes about were plotting the attempt to kill Hitler. This attempt was lasting over a four-year time period. When Dietrich then is going to jail, he knows that this plot is brewing, and he's waiting for it to happen. He knows that the 20th of July, 1944, is the day it was supposed to happen. The first two attempts didn't fail. They tried to blow up an airplane. It didn't work. They tried to shoot him. That didn't work. But he knew the third attempt was to be 20 July 1944. So on the 20th of July 1944, all you got to do is turn, or the 21st of July, you turn to this thing, to the letter he wrote on the day after. It failed. And he says, my only consolation are in the texts for the day, the three Bible lessons for the day, my only consolation, because he knew it failed. After it fails, they immediately arrest a number of people. One of the people they arrest is Hans von Danje. Go to Hans von Danje's house, and in Hans von Danje's desk, there is a piece of paper. They, for this whole four-year attempt, they keep one person keeps a journal, and I don't think they ever found that, but they did find the names of the conspirators, and one of the names they found was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Where is Dietrich? You don't have to look very far for him. He's in Tegel prison already. Okay. So, he is transferred from Tegel, which was a minimum security prison, full lockup and everything, but a minimum security prison. He was transferred over the next 6 months to Buchenwald, then to Schoenberg, and finally to Flossenbürg. He's 39 years old. It's the spring of 1945. Heinrich Himmler gives the order that von Danje and Beck was an admiral, okay? These folks that plotted this thing were not a bunch of slouches. They were very high-ranking people. Von Danje, Beck, the other people, and Bonhoeffer are to be executed at Flossenbürg. On the 9th of April, he is taken to a deserted laundry room. I showed you the picture there. And the trial is held. And... Then he is walked down some stairs to a schoolroom, and the prison doctor is allowed to watch. The prison doctor notes in his entry that that evening that he noted the executions that he observed that day, and one of the executions was of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So that happened on the 9th of April, 1944, and he was hung naked, and he was hung in the center of the schoolroom from a beam, up on a chair, and then they knocked the chair out from underneath him. 2 weeks after Dietrich is executed, his brother Klaus is shot by the Gestapo. The same day that Klaus is shot, his brother-in-law Rüdiger Schleicher is executed by the Gestapo. Three family members in 2 weeks are eliminated. This was spring 1945 to April 45. 3 weeks after Dietrich is executed, in other words, 7 days after Rüdiger Schleicher and his brother get killed, Hitler commits suicide. Okay? And 7 days later, the war is over. So from the time, it's 30-day time period, but when Bonhoeffer is hung at Flossenbürg, it's 30 days until the war is over. He wrote the poem in jail. O God, who dost forgive, who dost punish sin and willingly forgive, I have loved this people, that I have borne its shame and burdens and have seen its salvation, that is enough. Seize me and hold me, my staff is sinking. O faithful God, prepare my grave. And then he wrote a one-line entry in his diary just before he was executed. And the one-line entry is that death is the supreme festival on the road to freedom. Our next project in an after coffee is to look at the context of this experience within, that is namely the confessing church. Okay? And then we've got a whole lot more to do after that, and so why don't we have some coffee?